In this episode, find out how to stop oozes with a single mundane item, discover the lost art of bardic horse casting, or kill your level one character by celebrating. Welcome to Dueling GMs. I'm Joseph.
And I'm Anthony.
This is a show for GMs and players.
What about designs and details?
To build a better role-playing community. So let's talk about rules. We got some categories. We got rules as intended, rules as cool, and rules as written. Let's kind of break these down a little bit, huh?
Sure. I'll let you kind of jump in with your definition, but I think probably the easiest starting point is the rules as written, and then we'll maybe jump into why the other two categories are even needed. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So rules as written, how would you define that?
Well, it would be kind of what's in the books, in the content, source material, and just reading it and kind of interpreting the letter of the law, I guess you could say.
Yeah, as much as possible. This is not up for interpretation. We're just going with literally how it reads. Mm-hmm. And you may kind of scratch your head, but hey, that's how it reads. We're going with rules as written. Mm-hmm. What's maybe the upside? We'll talk in detail in a second, but what's maybe the upside of adopting rules as written?
Well, the upside is it's not open for various interpretations, meaning you kind of know as either the GM or a player that you know what you're getting yourself into. You like any board game that's out there, you know the do's, the don'ts, the hows and the how nots, and you build around that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what might cause us to have to fall into category two of rules as intended?
So rules as intended, I guess to define would be, you know, there is something vague, something nebulous, something that the letter of the law isn't clear. And so we go with the spirit of the law, so to speak, and try to wrap our heads around, you know, why or how this particular rule is in relation to the rest of the rules in the game.
Okay. So, for example, I'll come up with something just off the top of my head. For some reason, it's always jumping across, say, a chasm of some sort. That's the easiest example because I feel like people can visualize it pretty well.
Okay,
If rules as written says I can take a 5 foot or a 10 foot running start and have a running long jump that's equal to my strength score, my fighter having a strength score of 18 would allow me to jump 18 feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem comes in when most of us are doing things with visual mapping types of systems or the miniatures or whatever, and we move those in what increments? We're going in 5 foot increments, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm jumping 18 feet, where am I supposed to put my fighter?
Right.
Rules as written says I have to go 18 feet. But then we have to step in and say, okay, what is the intentionality here? Well, we need to also bring in the fact that if we need to round in anything in the game, unless it says otherwise, you're supposed to round down. So my assumption with 18 feet should probably be if I'm moving my miniature to say that I'm going to jump the 15 feet and anything else, I probably can't clear 20 feet. I can't round up. So the intention there is for me to be able to move 3 squares, but not 4 squares. And so we have to kind of step in and read between the lines just a little bit because they can't necessarily cover for every eventuality.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And there's a lot of reason why rules as intended is important to kind of sort through a little bit. What's maybe one of the primary advantages for rules as intended?
Rules as intended, I guess primary advantage might be, you aren't kind of breaking the system, so to speak, with certain, you know, nebulous aspects of a rule. You know, you kind of, you're trying to make everything on an equal playing field, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, we'll give some examples here in a second of when sometimes you think that you're doing the rules as written and you're being, we're going to do by the book and we're going to be the rules lawyer and we're going to be, you know, the no fun zone. and the players are like, well, the rules say this, and the GM who is going rules as written only has to kind of shrug their shoulders and say, that makes no sense, but okay, because the book says it. And so we have to learn to kind of step into what is the intention behind this, the spirit of the law, and not just the letter of the law.
Yeah.
But then that leads us to our third category, the rule of cool. And what is that?
That one is, if it sounds fun, let's do it. That, I think, goes beyond just, even if it's intended for something, if you are creative enough, kind of anything goes.
Yeah. So rule of cool may be with that same jumping across the cliff. Maybe you don't quite have the jump distance and you are not really good at athletics. And so you know you need to hit 20 feet. You've got a bad athletic skill and you know you can hit your 18. How are you going to get that other two? And so you kind of ask the GM, what if I'm going to, you know, run and climb up the back of the barbarian as I run and climb up, and then I'm going to jump off of his shoulders to get a little bit more leverage and a little bit more distance on that. And the GM could say, well, that's not the rule book. Or the GM could say, rules as intended. I feel like you probably would actually be slowing down at that point and you wouldn't get your running, you know, jump start. I don't think that's really what the book intended, what the writers intended. But if you go rule of cool, you're like, that sounds amazing. That also sounds like a train wreck waiting to happen. Give it a shot. I'll let you make the roll.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, oh, that sounds kind of badass. Let's see if it works, you know, yeah. Or it contributes to the story differently. Right.
Yeah.
I guess the focus for rule of cool is the story, and the other two are kind of the rounding of the mechanics.
Yes.
But all there to tell a good story, but just coming at it in different angles.
Right. Following the rules specifically provides the parameter so that everybody knows the story, that these guidelines for the story that's being told. Rule of cool says, we're going to throw parameters out the window because story comes first. And there's time and place for both of them.
Yeah. And just different groups have different, you know, preferences. And
sure.
You know, that's definitely something to figure out. So.
Right. And I think you got plans toward the end to kind of bring it back around. But I would say just like top of my head, in general, the way that I tend to run things is, if it is going to be an extremely cinematic finale to a particular encounter, whether it's a you know, skill challenge that you guys have been doing or a combat or whatever, I'll tend to lean into the rule of cool a little bit more. The other time that I'll allow it without too much issue is if it ultimately doesn't necessarily matter a whole lot. It drives the story forward in a fun way and it's not going to be game breaking. It's mostly just going to allow the people at the table or the people at your virtual tabletops to say, that was amazing. I'm ready to keep on going.
Yeah, because, you know, you'll remember probably a little bit more if you're, you know, fighter, the running jump off the barbarian shoulders than, well, I tried and I was told no.
Right. Or even the, I tried to make the jump anyway, and I grabbed the cliff, and then somebody pulled me up on the other side. Yeah, that's still okay, but it's not nearly as cool as, you know, jumping off somebody's back.
Right, right.
Yeah. Cool. So let's double back around then, and we've got a nice, fun list of why the rules as intended and the rule of cool are kind of necessary in the first place. You started kind of compiling this list first, and we ended up just going to town with a ton of things. So,
right now, this obviously isn't an exhaustive list by any means, but you know, we were just kind of thinking and spitballing and just jotting these all down from, you know, various sources and just our own reading of the rules themselves. So let's kind of go through the list a little bit. But yeah, I mean, some things are nebulous and some things you go, really? Is that what the...
Yeah, that's not how I read it.
Yeah, that's not how I read it, but so let's dive in. So, I mean, the first one that I have on my list is jumping and fall damage. So, rules is written, fall damage kicks in at 10 feet, regardless of where you start that. You know, if you're jumping from the ground, doesn't matter. If you are falling off a cliff, it's just, you know, 10 feet kicks in. So various races like the Herengon and Grungs, you know, those can jump higher than at least 10 feet. So,
yeah, the Grung has a high jump of up to 15 feet with or without a running start.
There you go. So just by jumping from the ground, you then start taking fall damage after, you know, starting at 10 feet.
Yeah, because there's nothing that mentions specifically that you also mitigate the fall from your jump.
Right.
The Herengon, it doesn't specify long jump or high jump. It just says you can jump a number of feet equal to 5 times your proficiency bonus.
So is proficiency at the lowest levels or is +2? Two?
Yeah.
So you're at 5 times that, just 10.
And if you are specifically a wizard with no constitution bonus, if that fall damage, one jump may kill you.
Yep.
At level one. You get a little bit less squishy once you get out of level one, level two. But yeah, level one wizards if you're jumping to celebrate your first victory against the evil goblins, watch it, because turn an ankle and you're dead.
Yep, you can jump, sprain your ankle, and die. Yeah, that was the first one that was on my list. What about you?
That's fun. Let's see. We'll start with something simple enough. There's a number of creatures at very, very low level, zero level CR creatures like seals, crabs, weasels, things like that, that have a +5 to hit, which means that they can pretty easily overcome the armor class of, well, adventurers, but definitely a commoner. And they deal 1 damage, which is all the hit points that a commoner has. So the implication that if you are out, you know, on the beach and a crab grabs you by the toe, you die.
So that's why you don't find too many commoners outside their villages, right?
Yeah, it's dangerous to go alone. Here, take this.
Yeah, you can't go. I've never been to the beach because of crabs and seals that could readily kill me.
Right. And the weasels are in the forest, so avoid that one, too. Right.
Nice. The next one that I had was kind of a very specific thing. There's a subclass for the warlock, the genie vessel. And there's maybe a couple that kind of fall under this category of it specifies that the player chooses the object or, the player has the choice on something. This specific subclass specifies that the player can choose whatever object that is for the vessel, but it doesn't specify if it can be magical. It doesn't specify, you know, if it needs to be anything at all. Just as the player, I get to choose.
It's a first level feature. It's meant to be like your genie lamp or something. So the only specification is that it's a tiny object and you use it as a spell casting focus. But the very nebulous, and you'll see this come up a few other times, you decide what the object is.
Yep. Yep. So, I mean, it doesn't stop anyone from saying, oh, this is a tiny ring, a magical ring, and it could be as extravagant as a legendary ring of 3 wishes, and now you have a level 1 character with a ring of wishes. So yeah, and that's kind of a quick because it's nebulous and it gives the player the choice, you got the option.
Yeah. And you could say, whoa, that's not what the intent was, but that's where the rules as intended comes up, because it doesn't specify rules as written. It is 100% the player's decision, and technically the GM can't overrule it, which is also kind of an odd wording.
Right.
Let's see. The next one on my list is an odd mix of, you have the opportunity to ride a mount into combat. And the rules in mounted combat refer to the fact that you can let them choose to act independently, or you can choose to basically make them part of your, what is the word? You can control the mount, or it can act independently. And then certain creatures that are intelligent will always act independently. If you're riding a dragon, unicorn, whatever the case is, you can control mounts only if they've been trained to accept riders. But then when you're controlling it, their initiative changes to be on your initiative, which is, that seems to make, you know, at least a reasonable amount of sense. All that it can really do, though, is dash, disengage, and dodge. Mm-hmm. So it's not attacking. It's not doing anything else. And it can move and act on even when you hop on them. That one makes some sense, but it's limiting in what the mount can do. If you're riding an independent mount, then it stays in its own place in the initiative order because, again, it's independent. So you run the risk of starting combat and you've got a really nice, you maybe roll a natural 20 on your initiative. You hop on your intelligent mount and then you just sit there and wait until your mount that got a 10 on their initiative takes their turn. And then your mount runs up into combat and then it sits there and you get pummeled by all the things in combat until your turn comes around so you can actually make your attack. And then you still have to sit there and get the idea of riding a mount into combat is you ride in, you attack, you ride away. You basically become kind of your own centaur type creature, kind of melded together, which is what the controlling the mount would allow you to do. But yeah, if they act independently, so basically the better the mount that you get, the worse you are at mounted combat.
I love the irony there.
Yeah.
Nice. The next one for me was, again, another, you know, you choose, but the spell Magnificent Mansion. It is a high 7th level spell where you can create your own interdimensional safe space, I guess. And it says, you know, you can furnish it and decorate it however you choose. And again, it doesn't specify non-magical items. So you could decorate your mansion to be, you know, a nice arcane library look and feel, decorated with scrolls, you know, spell scrolls just lined up the wall. And you can decide how many of those are wish scrolls. And, you know, the implications are very high there.
Yeah, it could literally be anything. And as long as you're casting it inside the mansion and don't take it outside, rules as written, furnish and decorate it as you choose. Well, I choose to furnish it with all of the crafting supplies that I could possibly think of. And I'm just going to hang out here for a little while and come up with some potions, you know, and I don't have to go buy any potion components because I'll just craft it in here in the mansion.
Yeah, or, you know, have a couple already made and you get in as you retreat and get all your ailments taken care of, get
right.
your health back up.
And Ocean of Giant Strength.
Yeah, and then just run back out the door and be ready to go.
Yeah. You don't even need a long rest, and it's better than the tiny hut because you keep running in, drinking, you know, superior restoration potions or whatever, and then running back out.
Yeah, you know, read off a wish spell before you leave and then walk out the door again.
Right. Yeah. So clearly not the intentionality, but it's the way that it reads. Yeah. Okay. We've dodged around this one, but let's tackle what for many people are an obvious, it's almost become a trope at this point. The coffee lock.
Mm-hmm.
So walk me through the coffee lock.
The general sense or the gist of it is you have the Pact of the Tome Warlock, Which is level 3. And then one of your invocations is Aspect of the Moon. That's yes. what it is. Took me a second. Anyway, so you don't need to sleep. And you can't be forced to sleep. And then, however, to gain the benefits of long rest, you spend all 8 hours doing light activity, such as, you know, reading the book that you have, your tome. And then combined with third level sorcerer, you need to have the ability to have magic.
Second level.
Okay. Yep. And then from there, because you're staying awake, you're not taking a long rest. You are taking 8 consecutive short rests. Yep. With the slight activity. You are converting your packed magic slot over to sorcery points just to have a nice slew of them, and you can refill, you know, a handful of your sorcerer spell slots as well with that too.
Yeah, and Xanathar's Guide kind of cleared that up a little bit because they made it obvious that if you do something like that and you're not taking a long rest after a certain amount of time, then you start taking points of exhaustion. So that brought up the next iteration. Instead of drinking coffee all the time, if you specifically go in as a celestial warlock, or you have a good buddy that's a cleric, then as long as you have a good supply of diamond dust, then your coffee lock can become the cocaine lock. And instead, whenever you take points of exhaustion, then you just snort a bunch of diamond dust, cast greater restoration on yourself, and remove the point of exhaustion. Bada bing, bada boom, rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
It gets a little more pricey, but still, at that point, you are creating, again, as written, an infinite number of pack slots available by spending your sorcery points, building everything back up, and just continuing to do your short rest to transfer things into your sorcery point slot. You can then spend it however you'd like later.
The next one on the list is also from the Warlock Devil Sight. It is an invocation that allows you to see in darkness, you can see both magical and non-magical in darkness up to a distance of 120 feet.
Which seems nice, yeah.
Yeah, it seems nice, right? However, it doesn't specify dim light. And in the rules, dim light is, you know, there are things such as disadvantage on perception checks, things that are different than having dark vision, or in this case, devil sight. Most races that have dark vision specifies as well how they see in dim light, which is usually, you know, normal, as if it was bright light. But devil sight doesn't do that. So, you know, rules as written, you have a harder time seeing in a dimly lit room than you do in magical darkness, which is interesting.
Yeah. See, you've got dark vision up to what I think, does devil sight extend your dark vision range or just
certain, not? No, certain, it's just a straight distance of 120 feet.
Yeah. So you're maybe 30 feet, 60 feet of dark vision will get you to a certain extent. But if you're playing, especially like a human that has, you know, no dark vision, and you're looking around in, you know, 15, 30 feet of dim lighting, you basically can't see anything for the most part. And then suddenly, oh, okay, after from 60 to 120 feet, I'm golden. I can see perfectly well there.
Right. You can see into the space between the stars and, you know, the abyss with perfect vision. But as soon as you light a candle next to you,
put it out.
You're having a hard time seeing.
Yeah.
So kind of interesting there.
Let's see what else. Sharpshooter. It actually makes it easier for you to hit a small creature that is 600 feet away from you behind 3/4 cover. It is easier for you to accomplish that with Sharpshooter than to hit a gargantuan creature who's only 10 feet away from you, and they just happen to fall down.
Yeah. Okay. Can I expand on that one?
Yeah. So sharpshooter allows you to fire your weapon, whatever it is, up to its second maximum distance without disadvantage. That's one of the features of it. So 600 feet away, I believe, is maybe the max for a longbow, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it also allows you to, 600 feet. It also allows you to ignore half cover and three quarter cover. So I can make a pinpoint precision shot with sharpshooter at a creature 600 feet away that is almost completely unseeable. Mm-hmm. But if there's a creature that is a 15 by 15 foot monstrosity 10 feet away from me that fell down, they have the prone condition. And one of the features of the prone condition is that ranged weapon attacks made at them are made at disadvantage.
I mean, you're selling yourself short right there. That's just a huge creature right there, 15 by 15. If you got
a true gargantuan, it's 20 by 20.
If you got a
by 20, technically.
Plus, right? So if you have the world serpent,
a Tarrasque could trip and fall in front of you, and you'd still be able to pick off a viper in the corner on the other side of town easier. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's fun, right? But I mean, rules is written. That's just how it works, you know. And while we're at it, being prone, you know, you got just the concept of standing up again, using half your movement, you know, for faster characters, just uses up more of their movement. I know some people kind of say, "Oh, it's about like, you know, it's." Of the 6 seconds you have, you're standing up for 3 of those seconds, or however people word it. But just the fact that you are faster to, you know, run, it's just interesting that you can't more movement to then move after that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So a 20th level monk, we'll even assume a human, has a 60 foot move. And so rules as written, if they're prone and they go to stand up, they would take just as long to stand up as a regular first level non-monk human would take to run 30 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they theoretically would be slower than the first level dwarf fighter who's wearing plate mail and probably not, you know, hardy enough for it. That's moving at, you know, 20 feet because he stands up at, with only using 10 feet of his move, and this monk fighter or this monk 20th level human takes 30 feet of move to stand up. Yeah, these old bones aren't like they used to be.
The adventuring pool, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I'll tackle this one. We promised you the lost art of bardic horse casting, and I'm here to tell you exactly how to implement this into your game. The Fine Steed spell, which is a fantastic paladin spell that far too few people make use of, allows you to summon a warhorse, a pony, a camel, an elk, or a mastiff, and it even gives you a nice little addition. Your GM might allow other animals to be summoned as steeds. All these little parentheticals just remind me of additional things that you could be like, ooh, I can break the game in this way. But that's not even how this works. Your steed becomes intelligent, which is great. You can choose celestial fae or fiend, so the flavor is amazing. It serves as a mount. You've got a bond with it, and so you can kind of communicate with it and that type of thing. And it's got this little sentence that says, while mounted on your steed, you can make any spell that you cast that targets only you also target your steed. And I think for the most part, the idea would be if you do cure wounds on yourself, then mm-hmm. you can also cure wounds on your steed, something like that. Mm-hmm. However, there are other spells that you could cast, especially if you are not a paladin. And you say, well, Anthony, you said this is a paladin only spell, except for the fact that bards have a fun little thing that starts at level 10 called Magical Secrets. And bards are mm-hmm. allowed to basically steal spells from anybody and everybody, including the paladin. So a 10th level bard could learn the Find Seed spell. Okay, well, that's a second level spell. That doesn't sound very exciting. No, except when I tell you that if you cast something like Vampiric Touch is a self spell and you are maintaining concentration. So you're basically getting a free twin spell on top of that. And when you make a melee spell attack against a creature within your reach, then they take 3d6 necrotic damage and you regain hit points equal to half that amount. So now you have a nightmare steed that is touch attacking things and healing itself while you're also potentially doing the same thing. There's a lot of fun other implications there, but those are the two that I think have the most bang for your buck. They have clarified in some of the errata, some of the sage advice that no, it doesn't count to do Cone of Cold, which technically originates from you. That's not the same. It says self, but then it says 60 feet in parentheses. They did clarify, no, that's not able to be cast from your horse. They didn't say anything about any of the other examples that were given, but Cone of Cold was nixed. So that is Bardic Horse Casting.
Yeah, is it self spells or other spells that you can target yourself? You know, ones that are like pick a creature you could see within X distance and you choose yourself. Does it then also choose?
You can make any spell you cast that targets only you also target your steed. So technically it's not just self spells. It's just a single target spell and you just happen to make that single target you.
Yeah. All right. Interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot of fun implications for that.
Yeah. Cause I mean the latest updates with like Booming Blade is a self spell now, right? So
now your horse. Now I think it may depend on how the natural weapon of the horse hooves read, whether that counts as a melee weapon attack or whether it's a net, you know,
they're intelligent. They know how to wield a sword in their mouth, right?
Ah, true. Yeah, yeah. I saw a video the other day of a velociraptor picking up a great sword and using that with its mouth. So clearly, a warhorse could do the same.
Exactly. It's pretty cool. So other things, you just target yourself. An aura spell or sanctuary or whatever that might be.
Yeah. Yeah. Tons of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot more implication there. That's cool though. I like that. Speaking of, just other buff and related things, we got resurrection spells.
Go on.
So yeah, I mean things like revivify or resurrection don't actually work rules as written. So when a creature dies, we have to start maybe asking the philosophical question of where is the creature at that point, or physically the body is there and without the soul, is it still a creature? The answer, rules as written, is it is an object. Corpses are objects, which gets weird now with resurrection spells. So things like revivify, third level spell to bring someone back, it's always touch a creature that is dead. Well, they're not a creature anymore. They're technically an object that you could pick up the corpse and eat it, and that's that, right?
Yeah.
So, resurrection spells will work because the soul is gone, and, IV kind of defines a little bit more aspects than just the physical body.
Yeah, and the intentionality there was for you to be able to do things like run over and pick up a body and cast Misty Step and get away with the body, where you can't Misty Step holding on to somebody. You have to do a dimension door or something like that. But if you're holding a dead body, it's just an object and you can carry objects with you. That was the intent behind it. But then, yeah, they shot themselves in the foot because you can't resurrect an object. You can only resurrect a creature.
Yeah. And maybe we'll kind of circle back to this thing of like, well, why didn't they just say a corpse, that is that, just bring back a corpse versus a creature, like that has certain meaning to it. Yeah. And it's interesting. But we can talk maybe more about that. So what else you got?
Well, I'm going to continue on the horse route.
Okay.
And this was a weird lay when they had it in the Unearthed Arcana. and they fix it so that it wasn't broken in one way. And in doing so, they kind of made it so that it was a different type of problem. The Centaur.
Yes.
The Centaur rules as written basically used to allow weird like stacking, which is kind of goofy, where Centaurs could basically stack on top of Centaurs and carry Centaurs because they also have a larger build. And so they can carry, you count as one size larger, which you you technically still do. But they worded out a few things because one of the running jokes was like the babushka doll. Centaurs on centaurs on centaurs. And it's not necessarily quite that way anymore. However, a centaur counts as a medium creature, and medium creatures can ride large creatures. Horses count as large creatures. The rules as written, your centaur character can indeed go in as a mounted combatant on a horse.
Okay.
And because you still count as one size larger when you have carrying capacity, if you wanted, you could have one of your companions on your back.
Nice. I like it.
So they replaced one pyramid stacking scheme with another one entirely.
Uh-huh. Kind of weird, but I like it.
Right. I don't know the actual implications of it, but, right? But picturing it is really fun.
Yeah, exactly. See, the next one I got is kind of going not resurrection, but just stabilizing a dying individual. In 5e and the skills, you can make a medicine check to try to stabilize a dying companion. It doesn't say anything about how close you need to be in order to stabilize them. It doesn't actually require any line of sight or distance or anything. So how close do you need to be in order for a medicine check? That's kind of a weird, I don't know if it falls under rules as written or rules as not written, maybe.
Rules as forgotten.
Yeah. So it's just kind of makes it.
As an action, you can expend one use of a healer's kit. So it doubles down, not just a medicine check. But I'm looking at the healer's kit. You can expend one use of the healer's kit to stabilize a creature that has zero hit points.
Oh, that's the healer's kit, though. I'm just talking about the skill. It's kind of the same concept, though, which is
right. Medicine check. Right, they don't clarify anywhere else. So medicine check lets you try to stabilize a dying companion or diagnosing an illness. No distance, no touch. You don't even have to see them. As long as you know that they're down, you can try to both diagnose what they died from, but also stabilize them. On the other side of the world, somebody sends a message spell to you, and you're like, oh, give me a second. Yep, he's got stabbed in the gut. Give me a second. He should be better now.
Right. Or someone said that they have a cold from, 50,000 miles away. Let me diagnose the illness from here. Okay. Yep. It's bronchitis.
Well, and if you have a healer's kit, you don't even have to make the check.
True.
You just thought, let me pour out a little bit of medicine on the floor. Okay. He should be feeling better now. Let me know.
Yeah. That's kind of a one weird one. And, though a lot of skills might not specify seeing or some obviously have like ones about hearing and whatnot. It's just kind of a weird, that's a particularly weird one for medicine.
Yeah, it definitely is. Let's see. Okay. Let me talk about barbarians.
Go for it.
On top of the fact that they've got an entire class feature that is designed around helping them bounce back up when they get knocked unconscious, and then the rest of their class is built around making sure they never get knocked unconscious because they're doing damage resistance and have maximum hit points. That's a weird rules as written. What are you trying to do here? But the other oddity is that barbarians who are raging, who throw weapons that are strength-based weapons, rules as written, they can't apply their rage bonus to their damage, even though it's still a strength-based throw.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it specifies rage attacks are only melee strength-based weapon attacks.
Well, I mean, it's specific, I guess. It's just
unfortunate. It is very specific, yes, and very unfortunate.
Yeah. Another thing about barbarians that is kind of more on the nebulous side, though, is the beast barbarian.
Oh, yes.
they have a tail attack that doesn't specify when the AC goes away. So could be with raging. It could be just at the end of their turn, the end of next turn, combat, who knows? So the implication there is it never goes away because it doesn't specify. So you can have yourself a beast barbarian with infinite AC.
Checks out, I guess.
Yeah.
That's where the GM has to say, like, am I going to take this the way that it's written? Or am I going to say, that's not what they meant?
Right.
Yeah.
Rules as written or rules as intended. Let's let the GM decide.
Okay. Let me read for you the lucky feat. People already kind of think that lucky is broken, but let me explain to you one more step in which that it is both more fun and more broken than you realized. Whenever you make an attack roll, an ability check, or a saving throw, you can spend one luck point to roll an additional d20. You can choose to spend one of your luck points after you roll it. Before the outcome is determined, you choose which of the d20s is used for the attack roll, ability check, or saving throw, right? Uh-huh. So that's not bad. However, this is saying you're rolling one, you can roll an additional one, and you choose which one you want to use.
Uh-huh.
This has been clarified by the writers in Sage Advice that technically, you're almost better off, if you're going to trigger the lucky feat anyway, you're almost better off attacking while blinded or just looking away and making the attack with disadvantage, because now you're going to roll three dice. And rules as written, you get to choose which of the three dice that you get to pick.
That's true, yeah. With the lucky feat, you turn disadvantage into super advantage.
Yeah, so they even said, that's just one of the things with it. If you're a lucky person, it makes sense. They kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, no, we didn't make a mistake in that. So you literally, if you have the lucky feat, you are better off attacking blind than being able to see your target.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Like, I would like to close my eyes to make this attack. But really? Yeah, sure? I'm feeling really lucky.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's good. All right, so the next one is Constitution, kind of what that means for rules involving eating and holding your breath. It's kind of interesting. So rules is written, a character can go without food for a number of days equal to 3 plus Constitution modifier. At the end of each day beyond that, character automatically suffers one level of exhaustion. A normal day of eating resets the count of days without to zero. So you have a max con of +5. You're looking at 8 days of not needing to eat before starving. And then from there you eat one ration and it resets to zero. Kind of fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, if you think about, like, you know, the large and in charge, you know, barbarian or fighter or paladin that have just a maxed out con, they are, you know, trucking along with all their equipment or muscle power, and they can survive a week ish without food, which I think is fun.
The flip side of that is,
yeah, the flip side is if you have very low or even negative constitution, you might be eating every day. And you have to basically keep your stamina up via the food that you eat. And, you know, you got to keep that up or you start to starve.
Yeah, it's kind of the reverse of what we think of with, like, high metabolism. People are usually the healthy buff ones and, you know, they keep the metabolism up, but they can just keep eating and eating. And this time it's the frail wizard that needs to constantly be consuming food or he dies.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, suffocating is another rule. It's 1+ the con modifier, which I think, yeah, it specifies a minimum of 30 seconds. So you can't have too low on that side. It's still low, but it's kind of a neat or weird thing to think about. You know, again, max constitution, being able to hold your breath for 6 minutes. I think that's pretty wild.
That is, yeah, that's excessive.
It's excessive, yeah. I always think it's fun for, like, carrying capacity or just, like, things like this where you're like, 6 minutes of, you know, holding your breath, that's not realistic. And then it's like, oh, hold on, this is fantasy. Right. There are other more unrealistic things that exist in this setting, but that's okay. But it's just kind of a unique rule that, though there isn't nebulousness, it's just fun to throw out that, you know, you can not eat for a week and hold your breath for 6 minutes at a time and you're pretty much good to go.
In the same week, and it doesn't affect you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a fun one.
Yeah. All right. I have a trick for you to shut down oozes, gelatinous cubes, all of those things that everybody is terrified of because they don't want them to engulf you. Right. That's the worst thing in the world is get engulfed by one of those things, especially at lower levels. What if I told you the best way to avoid becoming engulfed is to go up and give it a hug?
Oh,
because if the gelatinous cube or the oozes are grappled, then they cannot move. And if they cannot move, they cannot move into your space and engulf you. So next time that you're having issues with the gelatinous cube, instead of running away from it, you could just run up and give it a hug and prevent it from moving whatsoever. The other option, if you are a little dicey on that, because it still has the pseudopod hit, you don't want to take the damage or whatever, I can understand that. Pull out your dice bag and grab all of your D4s, chuck them on the ground, whatever it is that uses caltrops. So a gigantic gelatinous cube that fills, you know, a 10 by 10 foot square is going to stub its toe on basically a game of jacks and not be able to move anywhere because it's stymied by caltrops, which force a dexterity saving throw, of which they have a -4 and it's a DC 15 dex save. So they're almost guaranteed to fail the save. They take piercing damage, a point of piercing damage, and they stop moving that turn. And then taking the damage reduces their walking speed by 10 until they regain at least one hit point. So if they trip over two caltrops, they can't move the rest of their life, at least until they complete a long rest of their own to recover hit points.
Or a short rest, question mark? But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a fun little tidbit there. I like that. It's definitely might help the player out there.
Sure, yeah.
I like that.
And all the DMs shake their fist at me.
Again, rules is written.
I play like I see it.
Yep, don't blame us. Nice. So I got a couple of spells I'm going to kind of go through. Not all at once, we'll kind of back and forth still. But sure. The first one is the Enlarge Reduce spell. I know there's a lot of interesting things you can do with it in terms of, you know, enlarging, reducing the size of a creature. It's a level 2 spell. So it's kind of lower level for sure, but it does specify that you can increase or decrease the size of an object. Now, rules as written, an object is not a vehicle or a building, but pretty much everything else. In terms of interacting with objects.
Yeah, essentially, something that is made up of other objects can't be considered an object. But beyond that, anything else is an object.
Yeah, so which is a weird thing in and of itself, which might be worth put on the list here. As we talk about this, like, you know, you can interact with the door, right? But if the door has a doorknob, this might not work.
Hinges, it's got a few nails in it. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's an object that doesn't have any other objects, so
you can make that argument about a book's an object, right? But a book has binding, it has hundreds of pages in it. Well, now it's comprised of other objects.
Yeah. Yeah. That aside, assume it's just a singular object. The reduce spell, or the enlarge reduce on the reduce side, works really well with, well, things like doors, things like a portcullis. It's not really comprised of anything else. It's, you know, a singular lattice, you know, that's blocking your path into the castle, right? Well, instead of trying to think your way through or trying to figure out, you know, how to rush before the portcullis or the gate closes, you could just make it smaller. And it'll go half the size and you can slip on through. No questions asked.
Halved in all dimensions, and its weight is reduced to 1/8 of normal. So if you really want to, you know, dig that in real deep. You just pick it up while it's small and fling it frisbee style across the city. And so when it regains its size, who knows what kind of damage it does?
That's true. Yeah, and you can probably do that as a tactic, you know?
Yeah.
Throw some shrunken down cannonballs that are the size of ball bearings and hope for the best.
Or the worst.
Drop concentration midair and you're good.
Yeah.
That one's always a fun one.
Yeah, it definitely is. It becomes the ultimate like siege spell, or if you're trying to put the screws to a merchant and you say, are you sure you're not going to pay up this week? Because, you know, I could moita you. They don't do what you want. You just cast reduce on their roof, pick it up, readjust it slightly in some way. And then, you know, when it takes back full shape, then it collapses the entire house, you know, or just take the roof off and walk off with it someplace and let them see how they deal without having a roof on their house.
Or just enlarge the roof.
You could, yes, completely enlarge the roof and collapse the entire house. Yes. You can become the ultimate mobster.
Yeah. You got options there. And, you know, we kind of talked about this, on, you know, for high seas campaign setting, just, you know, you can enlarge the hull, maybe not the hull of a ship. Again, that whole objects, you know, and not vehicles, but the rudder you could change.
Yeah.
You know, the steering, you know, you can stop the wheel from.
You reduce it so they can't really, like turning it is not able to turn the rudder.
Or you make it larger and it, you know, hits the deck of the ship and it can't turn at all. You know, lots of unique options for it. Do you think, you know, if it changed size and shape, then change back in some other fashion.
And it's not exactly where it was.
Yeah. What chaos can be caused? So that's a unique one.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let me, another race one here. We went with a larger centaur type, but one of the fun things you could do with the older version of the kobold was to play off of their pack tactics, which arguably was already broken.
It was pretty strong. Yeah,
you can basically attack with advantage whenever you're near allies, that type of thing. Advantage on attack roll against a creature if at least one of your allies is within 5 feet of the creature and they're not incapacitated. The fun little twist you could make is if you are a kobold that has any means of acquiring a familiar, you just keep a little, you know, bug familiar, a little rat familiar in your pocket. They don't have to get into combat. They don't have to help with flanking, anything like that. Rules as written, you have an ally within 5 feet of you and you can always attack with advantage.
Yeah, that's makes her a pretty strong character right there.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe that's why it's legacy, who knows. No, I like that. Let's see, another spell that I got is might not be as nebulous in terms of, you know, rules as written or raw, but life transference. Essentially, you are hurting yourself, taking your life essence and applying it to a creature that you can see.
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 48 necrotic, which can't be reduced. And then you pick your creature and it gets hit points equal to twice that damage. Kind of interesting to hurt yourself to get healed even more from yourself.
Yeah. And I did the math on this. If you're taking 48 necrotic damage on average, that is 18 points of damage, right? Okay. And then you're going to heal yourself double that. Well, you're going to give yourself 18 hit points. You're going to give double that, but you lost it. So you would get 36, but you're making up the 18 that you lost on average. Uh-huh. So 18 seems to be the net healing average that you're going to get, right? If you cast Cure Wounds on yourself at third level, that's what, 3d8 plus your spellcasting modifier? That sound about right?
Yeah, around there.
We'll say your spellcasting modifier is a +4 at third level. If you, you know, play your cards right, your average healing at that point would be 17.5. So almost identical. You could probably play the odds with certain types of builds, however, that maybe lean into the necromancy side of things. There's probably some ways to make it work to guarantee better healing on that. But for the most part, this is one of those few instances where it's a weird oddity that you can sap your own life to recover twice as much as what you took. But the math kind of plays out to be almost identical to what an equivalent third level basic healing spell would have been.
Yeah. And they say wizards don't have healing magic.
Exactly. That is the upside. That's the one way for wizards to heal themselves. This is true. Let's see. I'm going to let you stick with the spells. And I'm going to keep on moving on to some other stuff here. So let me tell you a little bit about Player's Handbook subclasses and how they have the worst readings of almost any subclass out there. We're going to start with the Rogue Scout that gets a feature at 13th level. You excel at leading ambushes and acting first in a fight. It's called Ambush Master. Gives you advantage on initiative rolls, which is great. That alone is nice. 13th level, probably not necessarily the only thing you would want there. So in addition, the first creature you hit during the first round of a combat becomes easier for you and others to strike. Attack rolls against that target have advantage until the start of your next turn. So what this is saying is once you hit a creature in the first round of combat, then it's easier for you to hit that creature in the first round of combat as a rogue that only gets one attack. So really, it's basically saying if you hit a creature on the first round of combat, then all of your allies gain advantage on the attack. But it's either banking on you multi-classing into something else, which at 13th level rogue, it is probably unlikely that you are doing or have done, or it's just a really terrible rule written and they didn't even think about it. Because it's basically just giving your allies advantage.
Or it's kind of forcing the build to use offhand weapon
fighting. Yeah, if you're doing two weapon fighting, you can maybe have your bonus attack. Your bonus action attack with it. But other than that, if you're doing any sort of ranged fighting, if you're doing anything other than two weapon fighting, it's not going to be beneficial for you whatsoever. Hmm. It's a weird one.
Yeah. Unfortunate. All right. So the next one I got is Alter Self. It's a second level transmutation spell. One of the options you can, give yourself aquatic adaptation or natural weapons. But the one focus is kind of weird here under the change appearance section. You can transform your appearance. You decide what you look like, including height, weight, facial features, sound of your voice, hair length, coloration, and distinguishing characteristics, if any. So you can look anything else, right? If it was just looks, that's one thing. It specified weight as an option to change. However, it doesn't specify what that limit is with weight. So again, nebulous, right? Rules is written. You can transform into something and decide that your weight is 3,000 pounds and sit on someone, right?
Yeah. Or 30,000 pounds.
Or 30,000
pounds. Why stop there?
Yeah. And just utterly crush something because, if it was the weight of another creature or, I don't know. It just doesn't really specify. So
the implication of this is that your second level spellcaster can go into Curse of Strahd and theoretically make a grapple attack on Strahd in his house, use the Alter Self, and not only destroy Strahd because you turned yourself into a 300 ton creature, but also probably the sheer weight of that would destroy the mansion as well. As you fall through multiple floors, boom, 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 boom. You may kill yourself too, but man, what a way to go out.
Right. Taking out Strahd in his own home.
You could also flip it around too, because you could turn yourself, and I'm not able to think of any amazing implication for this, but just the idea that you could is fun. You could do the opposite and make yourself almost completely weightless.
Uh-huh.
You reduce your weight to just a few hairs, thickness, a hair's weight, and that's it. And you blow with a gust of wind and get carried away for hundreds of feet because you mm-hmm. weigh absolutely nothing.
Like Paper Mario.
Right.
Flip under a door. Yeah. Lots of fun options there. Being weightless and having no height.
Yeah. Slip through all the doors.
Exactly. I mean, even if you are still considered medium, but, you know, again, you can be 6 foot tall piece of paper.
Right. You know, 6 foot specify. Tall and yeah, paper thin and slip yeah. through. You can't go under the door, but you can slide through the crack in the side of the door.
Yeah, exactly. Or you just slip under the door because just 6 foot tall doesn't mean you're any wider right. from the door.
Yeah.
And you just slip you on just under and then. First. Yeah. Or being that, you know, sheet of paper and still being 300,000 tons.
Yeah.
Kind of a weird setup.
Yeah. But it's fun. All right. Here's your other player's handbook oddity. Eldritch Knights, number one. And we looked over this and we're pretty sure we're safe to make this statement, right? And nobody's going to come back and fire at us that we are dumb and don't know how to read.
If that's the case, feel free to comment and we're happy to discuss.
We'll take feedback however we can get it. Eldritch Knights were kind of the precursor to now what everybody else would prefer to play, which is Hexblades. So for the most part, if you're thinking about playing Eldritch Knight, the real answer is don't. But should you choose to go that route, know that if you're holding a two-handed weapon, you're going to have a little bit of trouble with your spell casting. If you're holding a weapon in one hand and a shield in the other hand, know that if you have any material components, you cannot cast spells. Unless you take Warcaster or come up with some other means, because unlike the Hexblade, you're not able to actually channel your spells through your weapon. Thank you, Player's Handbook, for not having a clear idea of where you're headed with your character development. But the worst part, at least for me, comes in the fact that the 7th level and the 10th level feature for the Eldritch Knight work against each other. The 7th level War Magic says when you use your action to cast a cantrip, you make one weapon attack as a bonus action, which sounds pretty cool, right? And then you get to the 10th level, you learn how to make your weapon strikes undercut a creature's resistance to your spells. And you're thinking, great, so now when I do the cantrip bonus action thing, they're going to stack, and cantrips are going to be better. But it reads, when you hit a creature with a weapon attack, the creature has disadvantage on the next saving throw it makes against the spell you cast before the end of your next turn. So in order to actually set up both of these abilities at the same time, you have to use your 10th level Eldritch Strike to make a weapon attack to give them disadvantage on the next saving throw on your next turn when you use a cantrip as a 7th level feature, so that you can make a weapon attack as a bonus action. So it's going to take 2 rounds to set up the ability to use both of these features when they very easily could have just flipped the War Magic. And when you make a weapon attack, you can use a bonus action to cast a cantrip or something along those lines. And they would have stacked and the subclass would have been way more playable. So rules as written, the one feature makes it very difficult to actually make use of the other feature and vice versa.
Yeah, that's just unfortunate.
Yeah.
But I guess it's not nebulous, which for better or worse.
It is pretty clear, yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah, that's definitely one that you can't argue rules as intended. What happened was what was intended.
Yeah, it's pretty cut and dry. It's just unfortunate.
Yeah, it's just poor decision making.
Right. I think the last spell that I have on my list is a 7th level spell, Mirage Arcane.
Oof. And this one we could probably do an entire podcast episode on with the amount of time you and I have just talked about implications of it. But give me the quick and dirty.
Yeah. So basically, it's an illusion spell that has some tangibleness to it, you know, weaving shadow magic into it. It's just there's a lot of discussions and sage advice on whether, you know, and how much that touch actually interacts with enemies, with people that believe the illusion, essentially. So portion one is just how much does it interact? Is it, you know, if you have it count as difficult terrain or things that you can't see through or can see through, if you have a tree Can you interact with it and climb it? Or if it's a tree with fruit, can you eat off of it?
And that's kind of the argument for a lot of illusion magic as a whole, right?
Yeah,
it's fairly nebulous. Mirage Arcane takes it a step in, like, it's not just a step, it's like runs in a mile in that direction. Let me give people the basics of it, and then you can talk about why it's all convoluted. You can alter terrain in an area up to a square mile, look, sound, smell, and even feel like some other sort of terrain. And just that sentence alone, you think, okay, well, I can turn it into looking like hills. I can turn it into looking like a swamp. That's not that big of a deal. It actually seems really weak for a seventh level spell. But you can alter the appearance of structures. You can add structures where no structures are present. It includes audible, visual, tactile, and olfactory elements. Those of you who are unfamiliar with that, that means you can smell it as well. So it can turn clear ground into difficult terrain or otherwise impede movement through the area. And then if you take any of the illusory terrain out, then it disappears. Where it gets even weirder, more dicey, is as long as you can see the square mile area, then you can cast at it because the range is sight in a mile square. So you could theoretically do this targeting from a hilltop, targeting an enemy town at the far edge of your vision. Rules as written, that can be a target. And it lasts for 10 days with no real easy way of getting rid of it unless you know for certain that it is an illusion, dispel it, that type of thing. So beyond that, what else is problematic about this?
Yeah, so it doesn't specify if the terrain is going to be dangerous, right? You turn the field. It doesn't specify. It specifies 1 square mile. It doesn't specify height, which is a big problem, right? If you can make structures appear, who's to say you can't have, 10,000 mile, skyscraper that is now just collapsing and it is falling.
Or the opposite into happening, where if you can create verticality, you can also reduce verticality. And what if you create a 1,000-foot cliff and people who believe it's true fall into the cliff and you are affected as if you actually fell into the cliff?
Right. It specifies open fields or a row could look like a crevasse. Well, how deep can that crevasse be? Like you just said, does it go to the center of the material plane? Who knows? And so there are things that you can cause some serious damage. And, that 1 square mile could be, walls that are, thousands of miles, up. And there's now just a giant crevasse where the entire town just basically gets swallowed up. And there's, you define at the bottom of this crevasse is just lava or poison, because that could be a terrain of just acidic poison, spray.
Yeah.
But whatever it might be, it doesn't say it could be, it has to be, safe or unsafe. It just,
yeah, so the implication here is you could totally convince an entire town that it's being destroyed by various means and they believe it to be true. Whether they're taking fall damage from something where they're actually burning up in the, hot lava, whatever the case is.
Well, and that's the other kicker, is just because they have true sight even and they disbelieve the illusion, they are aware that it's an illusion, but they can still physically interact with it, which means if I still have that wall with that lava at the bottom or the crevasse with involved, you know that it's an illusion, but that doesn't change the fact that you're falling or you are interacting with walls that don't exist there. And so who knows, what are you clipping through them? Are you not? It says you can interact with it. So, like, who knows, There's just a lot of questionable stuff there.
And then we've come up with a number of schemes you could pull on something like this, too. It lasts for 10 days. You cast a 1 mile radius and turn it into a dig site and claim that you found massive diamonds the size of your fists in here. And you find investors, bring them out. You show them said diamonds and you take buyers. You know, you sell this thing for 1 million gold on the open market. As long as all this happens within 10 days and then you yeet on out of there, you got 1 million gold in your pocket. And when that diamond mine disappears 10 days later, they can't track you down. Or when they try to take those diamonds that they mined out of the place, it disappears. And then, you know, what in the world just happened? But it's gone as soon as it leaves the area. Well, you're hightailed it out of town already.
Yeah, and you don't have to even go as big or extravagant as that, because you can have an appearance of a structure, and that could, who's to say that, like you said, it could be a stalagmite of gems, and you know, in the middle of town, or you know, you can have you know, what all is the limitation of these structures? Okay, a structure that is a bank full of items, gold coins, you know, like, or is it just the outside? You know, like, are there floors? Are there not? Can you? It's so nebulous that, you know, the fact that you're interacting with this thing, whatever that, you know, this is.
It's verbal, somatic, 10 minute casting time. It has no material components. You would think something this over the top would require some sort of material component that you lose. You could cast this 7th level spell multiple times, even in the same day, all over the place, and it lasts for 10 days. Over the course of a week, you could drop whatever random shenanigans you wanted all over the place. Send an entire religious order going bananas bonkers because you've uncovered all these shrines and relics all over the place that they didn't know existed, and they're going on this pilgrimage now. You're forcing them to leave, or encouraging them to leave their cathedral, heavily guarded cathedral, to go on this pilgrimage. And then, you know, the army that you're working with goes and invades the cathedral, burns it to the ground, and, you know, yay, no more religious order. There's so many weird implications for this thing.
Or again, just that cathedral's in a giant structural box and terrain, and the floor of it is lava. Or
the cathedral just collapsed. What are you going to do now? And for 10 days, they're still convinced that the cathedral has just completely bottomed out and doesn't exist anymore. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of fun stuff with that. But one, because of just how nebulous it is and the fact that you can still interact with it is
weird. All right, so I'm going to pivot and go back to the another race oddity, and this one's relatively short and to the point, but rules as written still makes very little sense. Monsters of the Multiverse started including a number of races that have the feature called Fey Ancestry, which gives you advantage on saving throws to avoid or end the charmed condition on yourself. The ancestry implies they come from the fairies, right? Or the Feywild. So you would imagine the number one creature that would have that would be the fairies. However, fairy traits include fairy magic and flight. Fairies do not have Fey ancestry. Yeah.
Love the irony.
Short and to the point, but rules as written, fairies are not Fey. That's basically the takeaway from that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's wild. But elves are, so maybe because they're not ancestors, kind of our term. I don't know. Just trying to help them out here, but
yeah. This is not the type of thing we can suss out. I think they just realize, hey, they've got spellcasting and they can fly, so we probably should also give this additional feature to them. They probably should have changed the term Fey ancestry if the actual ancestor does not have that feature.
Sure. All right. And I think to wrap up my spell casting stuff here, I guess it's kind of a two-parter. I don't know if it's, you know, just be a friendly reminder for some people because it is just, you know, rule there. But, you know, for me, you can't cast two spells in the same turn unless one of those is a cantrip with a casting time of one action. So maybe that's the unique part, is just the cantrip with a casting time of one action. So technically, if you cast a spell and you are looking to do a bonus action cantrip, you can't do that.
Yeah. On the same vein, if you are casting spells with a time that is longer than one action, however long it takes you to cast that spell, you are actually maintaining concentration on the spell. And so anything else you were concentrating on breaks concentration. This includes if you are holding a spell as an action, which most people don't realize. Holding a spell as an action actually requires you to spend the spell slot immediately, concentrate on the spell, and then cast it when the trigger happens. So if you are concentrating on something else and you decide to hold a spell cast, you immediately lose concentration on the spell. You spend the spell slot, you have to hold concentration, and then if you don't end up triggering it, you still don't get that spell slot back. It's gone.
That's true. You're refocusing, and if you don't use it, you lose it. Those are both
rules as written, and they're not necessarily oddities. They're just rules as written that most people don't realize are rules as written. Believe it or not, probably every table you've sat down at is using some sort of homebrew rules, and I would almost guarantee nobody is playing 100% by the book.
That's true. And you know, house rules and, you know, they change the game for better and worse. They do have an impact on the game.
Yeah, right? For sure. They definitely do. And for the most part, the idea is we're going to make it more fun. We think that rule's dumb. And any of the arguments that anybody has about when we point these things out, you know, somebody's going to listen to it and not want to listen to this entire list because their thought is, well, just change it if you don't like it. You know, stop making a big deal about it. Everybody's having fun the way that they like to have fun. Yes. However, no. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, house rules work if everyone agrees to it. It's not just, I feel like a lot of times the GMs just say, I don't like that, or it's a lot for the players, or it's, you know, they kind of make that decision on behalf of everybody. They're not necessarily being antagonistic, and it might be for the betterment of the group. However, there are things that should be discussed with everyone at the table, you know, asking if that's the rule they want to switch to, just because it's maybe easier for you, the GM, could actually be taking away fun from one of the players, right, or more.
What's an example of that?
So I know, like, at our table, a common house rule that we use is interacting with potions, or even potentially just interacting with objects as a bonus action, right? Some people say, oh, that's simple. It's, you know, it speeds up combat, so you're not just spending your whole action drinking potions. You know, you get to do a few more things, right? It makes combat a little bit more violent. Great. However, if you have yourself an arcane trickster rogue in the group, they have a whole aspect of that subclass where they get to interact with objects as a bonus action with their mage hand. So you are giving everybody something more to do. However, you are now making that character's subclass lesser, and because of that, so there isn't an impact that they, you know, and it might not be right away, right? You start off at level one, you say, I don't know what kind of rogue I'm going to be yet, and then you're like, oh, the arcane rogue sounds good, but now one of the features is almost pointless because of just a house rule. You know, there is an implication there, so I think that definitely deserves conversations. I don't think that the player needs to have that answer as to what rogue they're going to be, but now that everyone can do what that rogue is good at, and, you know, some portion of what the rogue is good at, you got to figure out how to rebalance that. What does that look like to rebalance? Do you take away that bonus aspect from everybody else? Do you give them something even more they can do as an arcane trickster rogue? These are the questions you definitely.
And it's worth asking specifically, okay, if you have, in this instance, if you have an arcane trickster, talk to them and say, here's what I'm thinking about doing with the rules. Here's how it may negatively affect you. And so as I'm reading this a little bit more specifically, the Mage Hand Legerdemain, the arcane trickster may look at you and say, well, that's not how I would have used it at all. Because Mage Hand allows you to work up to 30 feet away from you. And so when you have the stolen object, the Mage Hand is holding in a container worn or carried by another creature, retrieve an object in a container worn or carried by another creature, use tools to pick locks and disarm traps at range, those types of things. And it says you can use the bonus action granted by your cunning action to control the hand. Okay, cool. All those are useful, and the rogue could look at that entire situation and say, well, everybody else can still pull a potion out. I want to pull a potion from, you know, the enemy 30 feet away and bring it over to me and drink his potion. That's the type of thing that I want to do with this. And so it doesn't completely eliminate the third level capability. It just kind of mitigates it a little bit. And so it's worth talking to, because the GM could do the opposite too. I've been in that world sometimes where I'm like, oh, this may break somebody's thing. But when I bring it up to them, they're like, oh, I didn't even realize that was a thing that, you know, that wasn't my focus, right? I didn't realize I could do that. And I'm like, well, sorry, I told you that this, house rule was going to ruin it, because apparently, it wouldn't have affected you whatsoever. So that's where going back and making sure you establish, parameters on both sides, the GM and the player, to figure out rules as intended. And then do we want to tweak anything together, make that decision? Because again, you could decide as a GM not to do things because you feel like you're helping the players and it may not be helping them at all.
Yeah. And even just, house rules aside, that rules as written versus rules as intended. We talked about a lot of spells. If I'm a spellcaster and I'm kind of anticipating certain expectations of my spells, I don't want to be totally caught off guard if each and every time you're saying, oh, well, as written for this one, as intended for this one, kind of like, oh, well, now I don't feel like this is what I wanted anymore.
When I took this spell and I ask you, is this okay? And you said, yes, I thought yes meant yes. Or even worse, last time I cast this spell, you said it was fine. This time you're reinterpreting the spell. So that's, again, where we've talked about this before, that anytime you feel like there's tweaks, changes that need to be made to the game, talk about it, not in the middle of the session, and make sure you clear it with everybody involved. You're not making an overarching decision that changes everybody's characters without clearing it with everybody first. So there's definitely an element of communication that needs to be involved for any of your house rules. Even if you think it's going to make things more fun, make things, a lot more exciting, whatever the case is, make sure you clear it with the players, because at least the expectation is we're going to play this rules as written, except for XYZ that you all agreed to in session zero.
And, we've talked about that ad nauseum with session zero, but, you just want to make sure that level of mutual respect and that type of contract, like, from what I know about the rules, we're going to try to play it by the letter of the law or the spirit of the law, or because it's badass and it's cool. So if you agree to that, or if there's going to be changes, we'll talk about it. But then, if you jump on board, we're all going to hopefully be on that same playing field and expectations there. So I think that's definitely important to have. And then you're not being blindsided when they're trying to reduce the hull of a ship or enlarge the roof of a merchant's house. Hold on, we talked about this, like, within limitations, whatever that previous conversation was, hopefully. Or if it's rule of cool, you're like, heck yeah, let's try that out. Gonna make for a unique, fun aspect of the story, then by all means, like, But just kind of having that, knowing what you're getting yourselves plural into is important, so that it's not like, oh, well, now the GM took that away from me. Well, now I'm going to try harder to fight back, and now it's turning GM versus player, or, oh, well, look at them, they did it that way, and then they just changed it halfway through after I picked the arcane trickster, and, you know, I already had these thoughts in mind, you know, whatever that is. You don't want to feel robbed of fun, yeah. Whoever you might be, GM, the player, someone else at the table, like, oh, well, they do it this way, why can't I do it? What makes their character do it? Different things like that. So this end tangent, I suppose, but else rule, or, you know, the type of rules, just that it's clear and that it's discussed so that people can have fun and, you know, you're not sort of dictating.
Right. Yeah. I'll end my portion with bringing both into focus, the house rule aspect and the rules as written. One more thing that people probably believe that they're playing rules as written, and they are not. They're actually playing house rule, or at least a written variant. If you play D&D 5th edition and you play with flanking, you are not actually playing rules as written. You are playing an optional combat variant. And you might think,
There's a lot of variant rules in the book.
And I think we need to do a podcast about all of the things that people are writing homebrews for that are already included in the book. They just haven't bothered reading it, because there's a ton of those out there. I started making a list of those as well. So we'll definitely probably tackle that soon. But yes, if you are playing with flanking rules, there's nothing wrong with that. But number one, don't say, I play by the book, I play rules as written only if you're playing with flanking, because that's an optional rule. You're technically kind of house ruling, home brewing a little bit of your own thing. That's fine. We play with flanking because it makes things more fun. The players like to roll extra dice, roll with advantage. Everybody likes rolling extra dice. That's great. And the opportunity for crits are higher. The opportunity for damaging is higher. That's great for the players. But if you're a DM, trying to figure out why your encounters are going sour so much, well, ask yourself, am I allowing flanking? Are my players taking advantage of flanking? If so, you're probably decreasing the potency of your monsters because you're getting flanked all the time, which, again, not necessarily a bad thing. But now we go back to your example with the arcane trickster. Who potentially stands to be penalized with flanking rules?
I would say probably the main boss and ones that have less
economy. The lower action economy definitely loses out on that for sure. What about your spellcasters that get surrounded by the flanking enemies that they have kind of sort of okay armor class, but if they're rolling with advantage, the likelihood of them getting hit goes up, right? It may not negatively affect your tanky fighters. It may not negatively affect the barbarian that has damage resistance and three times as much hit points as everybody else. That's not necessarily as problematic. But your squishy casters, it may be worth double checking and saying, are you okay with flanking rules? Because it may negatively affect you. That's one person you probably haven't thought to ask. The other two people that I can think of that you would, at a glance, think would probably be perfectly okay with it, but you're also eliminating entire aspects of their class builds, are barbarians, because why would you ever recklessly attack if you can just flank? It's giving you the same feature.
That's true.
You're rolling with advantage, but now you have no downside. Of course, I would like to do it, but at some point, I'm going to feel like I'm getting cheated out of an entire level 2 feature, right? Or level 1, whatever it is that you get the reckless attack, your entire feature is virtually worthless. It triggers, you know, less than half the time because I can just get into flanking with somebody. The other one,
right. And the bigger party, the more
flat. You have a larger party. Basically, you have a flanking chain. Ally, enemy, ally, enemy, ally, enemy, and you have a straight line, and then you have somebody cast lightning bolt just to fry everybody because maybe that's just me. Yeah. The other class that I can think of that would negatively be affected by this is most variants, most subclasses of the rogue, because they also have means of giving themselves advantage, because that's the entire point of triggering their sneak attacks. And again, you would say, well, rogues would be on board because they just want to sneak attack all the time. Yes. However, when rogues only get three subclass features anyway, something like that, maybe a fourth, but their subclasses don't give them a whole lot. And one of them for most of the rogues is a specific way for that particular type of rogue to get advantage on an attack. And it's way easier just to run up and flank. You're eliminating the usefulness of that particular subclass. It would be better to talk to the barbarian player, talk to the rogue player, and say, look, I know you'll get advantage in a number of ways here, literally by getting advantage. However, I don't want you to feel like your class and your build is worthless because I'm allowing everybody basically to have a feature that you have written into your class. So even something as simple as flanking should probably be discussed and make sure that everybody's on board with it and they understand that it may actually fly in the face of how their character works.
Just you're making me think of just two other thoughts there, if you don't mind me adding, but you know, like encumbrance, right? No one likes it. Most people don't like it, I guess. I don't know if that's a true statement, but some tables don't find that fun. You are kind of robbing the strength based build of not necessarily being the quote unquote pack mule, but the one that is capable of doing these things. And so Malthan is like, oh, I'm going to drag someone over. Do we count equipment? Do we count? We haven't been doing encumbrance thus far. Maybe we have, you know, the strength based, you know, character doesn't get to do that as much. You know, there's just kind of like,
it doesn't really matter that I'm strong, like, or not strong, because I could wear full plate mail and carry a shield and, you know, 13 different weapons because we're not tracking it. Oh, and my strength is an 8.
Yeah. And then like other things like races that either don't need sleep or don't need food. Now, though, you might not have originally intended to have people start tracking weapons or hours of sleep, you know, for night watches. Now you have someone in the group has made it a point that that's what they want. You know, they want to be special in that sense. And so you might need to actually introduce that so that the rest of the party does it by the book so that they feel special.
Right. And it's not just a hand wave that, you get 4 hours instead of 8. It's fine.
And nothing different happens. Or, I wasn't even tracking food. You know, I wasn't having everyone track food anyway. Well, I'm a warforge. I don't need to eat at all.
I'm reborn. You know, I'm just going to scratch this part off my character sheet. Thanks for telling me that's not necessary.
Exactly. So things like that, like the tracking the nitty gritty aspects might be encumbering as a mechanic. You can change that to not, you know, like, okay, at the end of this month, everyone deduct or or food. You don't need to go and open the whole game, but say, okay, except for Reborn and Warforge in the party, you're fine. Don't eat, you know, something. So kind of hand waving some aspect, giving them benefit of something that maybe no one else has. So
cool. Yeah. Those are good examples. All right. Well, I think that's everything on our list. And we definitely touched on differences between rules as written, rules as intended, and the fun you can have potentially with rule is cool. And then we also talked about the implications on house rules and the ups and downsides to just hand waving things or, you know, making a decision you feel like would be fun and talking through with your characters, your players, whether that actually has negative implications that you didn't think about. Do you have any parting shots beyond that?
Like you said, I think another discussion of variant rules is in order. And I think, you know, again, we always circle back to as long as everyone's having fun at the table, but also don't try to dictate that, you know, get that consensus from everybody. And, you know, and if that needs to change, again, have another conversation with the whole table and see what might impact both good and bad.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, make sure your fun is not dictating other people's fun, because that's not fun for anybody.
Right.
Yeah. Cool.
Yep.
Well, good. That was a fun little list. I'm sure that that was a number of head scratchers for some people, and for other people, they're frantically writing down notes and saying, "I'm going to build a character around this." If you're that type of person, I encourage you to go back and find our twisted builds, because a lot of what we do is wrapped around these types of weird quirkiness.
And if you want to add to this list, post a comment, and
if we come up with another, five or 10 of them or whatever, I'm sure we'll do circle back around and go down the next list as well. And I'm sure with the one D&D coming up and all the errata and that type of stuff, the Unearthed Arcana playtest, we'll probably come up with a number of other things that we can say, hee hee hee, this is funny. Exactly. Until then.
Well,
yeah, catch you later.
Have a good one.